Blog Talk Radio. It's Blog Talk Radio, and it's rebooting the news. This week, say hello.
Hello.
That's not Jay, is it? Your name isn't Jay, is it?
My name is not Jay.
What did you do with Jay?
Jay's not feeling well.
Oh, really? Yeah. No, that's Jonathan Glick, who is the CEO of T-Lists, Inc. Did I get that right?
That's right.
T-Lists, Inc. And Jonathan, I first met Jonathan at... he was introduced to me by Fred Wilson.
That's right.
Fred, who is the VC of the hour, or maybe even VC of the decade.
Mm-hmm.
He's sort of the rebooted Silicon Valley VC of Union Square Ventures. He's also an investor in Twitter, makes him very famous. And I was looking for somebody to partner with. Didn't happen, but I met Jonathan and was very immediately impressed with Jonathan's intelligence, and so over the years we've become friends, and now that I'm here in New York, we see more of each other.
Yeah.
Which is something I'm very pleased about.
Very nice.
Of course. Yeah. So so with Jay calling in sick, I sort of thought, well, who would be an interesting person to get on Rebooted News, you know, rebooting the news, and I thought of Jonathan right off the bat, because I think in many ways your career exemplifies the Rebooted News process. Because you, well, I don't know if you started out there, and you should tell us a little bit, a brief summary of, you know, how you got to be where you are. But sure. Before you started T-Lists, what were you doing?
Well, it's interesting. I actually never thought about my career this way. But yeah, you could almost think of the things that I've been working on as a sort of steady...
Well, tell us about it.
Yeah, okay.
Before giving us the theory,
okay.
Tell us
about it. All right, so yeah. I'll let you make your own conclusion. So my first job was at iVillage very mm-hmm. early on. Before it was a woman's site, it was going to be a network of sites oriented around baby boomers. And I got started there building content management systems and publishing tools, much of which interfaced with AOL, because AOL was a big investor and partner of iVillage. And then I ended up as the head of product development and technology for the New York Times on the web in an earlier phase of its existence.
What years was that?
Boy, I think it was 96 through 99
mm-hmm.
Under the brilliant leadership of Martin Nisenholz.
Martin is a great guy.
And and then after that, I got involved with Jerry Colonna, who really liked an idea that I had about creating a platform for media companies to manage very, very large networks of stringers and experts and contributors, which is an idea which has become very, very popular these days. At the time, it was very hard to convince media companies that this was the way of the future, that they should
mm-hmm.
have a smaller in-house full-time team and a much, much larger external network.
Mm-hmm.
So that company was, I guess, before its time. And
who is Jerry Colonna?
Jerry Colonna was Fred Wilson's partner.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in the VC firm that I guess you could say kind of preceded Union Square. It was called Flatiron.
Flatiron, right.
And Jerry was a brilliant media thinker and still is. And I had come to him with this idea, which we had started working on at the Times, to create this platform for, you know, I guess, rebooting the news, right? The
Isn't that interesting? Because that was what I was pitching the Times on doing. Our paths didn't cross in those days, but I was talking with Martin. You know, I had two things I wanted the Times to do. One was to open up the feeds that they had. They had an internal XML format, and I just happened to trip over those files. Somebody sent me a pointer to a directory on the web with all these XML files in it. And he did that. He made those into RSS feeds and sort of drove the adoption of that. The other thing I wanted was for them to offer a blog, a New York Times hosted blog, to everybody who had been quoted in a New York Times story. Mm-hmm. I thought that would be a way of vetting people's authority. If they had passed the test of, you know, being quote-worthy in the Times, then why not, like, host their thinking, you know, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and... Yeah. You know, 365 days a year. That way, you broaden the thing immediately. You know, it's the reporters become recruiters, and you develop this brain trust. If I had managed to get that idea, so I imagine you would have been the guy to implement it.
Yeah, at that time, I would have been.
Yeah,
I mean, the reason. I mean, there's a lot of people who were involved. The company was called Outer Force, which mm-hmm. you can tell why. And it was really hard. I mean, to convince a a publication that 1999 or 2000 was the peak, and that things were going to get harder for them, and if they wanted to be relevant and to be
Even today, it might be hard to convince
them. I think it is hard. But
there's a lot of like wishful thinking and denial in the news business.
Yeah, I mean, I think for good or bad, SEO. Well, actually, in many ways, mostly bad. I think SEO has changed the way people think about this, and because it's so obvious to most media companies that they need to create lots and lots and lots of findable content to be found in search engines, and as a result, they're much more willing to experiment with these outer force-like ideas today. And in a way, that's a little sad, because I think just being found in a search engine is maybe the least interesting thing you can do with a huge cloud of contributors.
So.
But it's why you see, you know, virtually everybody talking about this idea now. And it is certainly a part of the future of media.
Yeah, I don't think it's the biggest idea out there. I think advertising revenue is small potatoes for the publisher. Relatively small potatoes compared to concentrating high value information, high dollar value information.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because the next job I had, which was directly connected, was being the sort of the head of operations and products at a company called Gerson Lehrman Group, which Reuters just wrote I think an unfairly mean article about. But Gerson Lehrman Group is the first and biggest expert network, which took the same idea that we had at Outer Force, and it applied it to directly providing high-value information to people who are willing to pay for it.
Yes.
And that's what you're getting at, I know.
No, that's not actually what I'm getting at. No, but it's an interesting idea. It's not what I'm getting at, because what you are selling is, if I understand it correctly, you are selling to very small numbers of people very valuable information that is only valuable if it's scarce.
Right.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about mass markets that are going unserved, and where if you focus reporting resources on those areas, you might actually be able to invoke investment there, and in the process of doing that, become a shareholder in it. You know, a great example, there was a national broadband policy statement, which is like highly watered down, not likely to do anything, really, from what I hear at least, published last week by the FCC. And meantime, you know, I know because I'm a recent purchaser of broadband in Manhattan, I know exactly how appalling it is here in the country's largest city, in some sense the most important city there is. You know, you can't buy great internet in almost everywhere in the city. And you know, my feeling is that if we were better informed about the reasons why and the politics of it and who's bribing whom and where where is Fios in Manhattan? Is it anywhere? I mean, according to Verizon, it's somewhere in Manhattan. But, you know, it's like make a cookie hunt, you know, an Easter egg hunt out of it. Can anybody find the Fios? Raise your hand if you have Fios, right? This is one of Jay's idea. Actually, it's Jay's primary idea these days. He calls it atomization, where you have so many people gathering information that you can start approaching questions that you just simply couldn't have approached with, you know, with reporters, you know, in shoe leather. It just, there wouldn't be enough hours in the day for them to get the answers, you know.
Yeah.
But here, in terms of cracking this nut, if there was a website that you could go to and you could actually learn everything about broadband in Manhattan, that might actually, I don't know, once we learn what it is, it might actually change the market. If there is Fios in Manhattan, I bet the rents on those apartments would go way up as soon as you knew where they were. Or if Fios is coming next month, a guy I communicate with on Twitter says, my building on Bleecker Street in the West Village is going to have a Fios in May. Yeah, we'll have a big party if that happens.
Right.
So, I mean, that's my thought, that there's a lot of money sitting there. And if you really became the place where everybody went to get that, and there are a lot of other examples of that, that there would be a lot of money there for you. I think in many ways that's the game of the internet, is identifying those places and then becoming the central place for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Rotten Tomatoes, for example.
Sure.
You know? Who would have thought? I mean, I'm sure they make lots of money. Do they? Do you think, Jonathan?
I think...
they make some money.
Some, yeah.
No? Okay. Some. Anyway, all right. So, have we gotten current? No, because there's one more thing after the expert systems. You now have TLITS.
Oh, yeah,
right?
TLITS, which yeah. I guess if you are keeping score at home, might be considered kind of the next logical thing. What we're doing, and we're starting with Twitter, is we are we're creating channels of high quality feeds on just about every topic you can think of by using the Twitter list metadata that millions and millions of people on Twitter have been using to categorize their own feeds. So what we've done is we've created a search engine of Twitter lists. We've used that that index to categorize those lists when possible into one of 500 categories, more coming. And then within every category, we take those lists and we synthesize them. So for example, for healthcare reform, we take the Twitter list that was created by the Huffington Post and the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and the Atlantic Monthly and the Heritage Foundation and all these other amazing places, as well as dozens of passionate independent individual experts. And in real time, we continually synthesize them. So, for example, yesterday, it was just a fantastic experience to be able to tune into this super list of healthcare reform feeds, because all of those curators were in real time updating their lists. So new sources were flowing into the super list, this kind of this river of all these different tributaries. And meanwhile, all of the people in the list we're creating lots of real-time content, including retweeting people who are outside the list. So it was
Where is that super list? What's the address?
So you can find it on Twitter most easily at twitter.com/tlists/health-care-reform.
Health-care-reform.
Yeah, I mean, sorry about the hyphens. That's the way Twitter does their slugs. But
no, don't be sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have no more than 500 lists. So.
Yeah, well, we have we call them super lists or channels. We have as many as we want. And in fact, if you go to tlists.com right now, you can type in any keyword and you can click on the button that says create a super list. And what that'll do is it'll take the query you've just run and all the lists that were returned, and you can pick the, say, 100 lists that you want to mash up, and it will create instantaneously a super list composed of the individual curatorial decisions of all those individual editors.
So it's a sort of a union of all of their lists?
Yeah.
I see. Interesting.
Yeah, it's very dynamic, and that's the exciting thing, right, is that when you have a topic like healthcare reform, which works really well, or the Olympics, or anything that people are passionate about, the individual curators are always out there looking for new stuff to add or things to remove, and so it's the synthesis of all of those independent decisions that bubbles up and creates, I guess in some ways like Wikipedia, a kind mm-hmm. of crowdsourced channel.
Yeah, you said something intriguing. You said that you're starting with Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
So what's next? What do you
well,
do?
I mean, so that I think is a I think we're gonna try to figure out how to use Google Buzz actually. We played around with Facebook content, and there's tons of public Facebook content now as a result of the switch to default public. But the content isn't content-y. In other words, it doesn't tend to be for public consumption. It tends to be for – it's mostly a private conversation that somebody probably didn't realize was being made public. So it's a little harder to create high-quality channels out of that content. But Google Buzz – maybe as that matures and becomes a place where, you know, for sort of independent publishing, which it might, that might be the number two source to go with.
Mm-hmm.
Alternatively, it'd be great to see a kind of blog-like solution emerge where, you know, mm-hmm. people were creating a sort of microblogs that we could tap into in some convenient way. Obviously, it's really nice to work with centralized systems like Twitter or you know, or Google Buzz, because then you have sort of one simple place to go look for content. But,
right.
you know, over time, these things have tended to democratize.
Yeah.
And just like blogs did with publishing in general.
Well, that was what I originally came to you about when we first met with Fred Wilson. At the behest of Fred Wilson, I had this this project called share.opml.org.
Mm-hmm.
So share your OPML. So, yeah, I mean, I think an open version of all this stuff would be great.
Well, you're actually one of the only people who even relates the Twitter list concept back to OPML, which, of course, is really what it is.
Right. Well, that's what we were doing, right? I mean, OPML reading, they, you know, well, you can go beyond just the subscription list idea, which, of course, is a pretty cool idea. You know, if you export the things that you're, the feeds that you're following, then you could share those with other people and they could learn, you know, and you mash them all up and all of a sudden you can have a recommendation engine for that stuff. That's actually not very hard to do.
Right.
But then there's the next level where you get to, and eventually this is going to, I mean, in my career, I've had this experience over and over and over again where, you know, I say, look, everybody is going to be doing this. I'm sure of it. And everybody gives me all the reasons why that will not happen. You know, we're actually doing this and you're over the hill. I hear that all the time. I've heard that at every age, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45. I'll hear it next year at 55 or this year, actually. 2 months.
Yeah, 55. Congratulations.
You know, but it won't be true. Knock wood. But the eventually it'll happen. That's what I've seen over and over again is that, you know, if you can extrapolate the general case, it just takes more time than you wish it would take to actually happen. You know, so people then subscribe to these reading lists or subscription lists, and then when you add something to a list or remove it, then they automatically subscribe or unsubscribe from those things too. And you build these networks up of content flows that, you know, I mean, who cares how they got to you? The point is that you're getting more and more relevant over time as people become more educated about what's out there, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. That, at least that's the hope.
I mean, I think that, I mean, there's a million really great things about Twitter, but yesterday for me watching this flow of content through this healthcare channel was just, it was amazing because it was by far, I was checking all.
Well, what did you see? What did it look like for you? I mean,
it just looked like a timeline, right? But I could see as the algorithm was being rerun and rerun, new people being added as, you know, the New York Times or the Huffington Post or the Wall Street Journal or some individual found some new valuable person and added them into the list. If two or three of the curators all had discovered the same person, that person gets flowed in. Also, because a lot of them were looking at the super list and borrowing back from it, you got this very, very powerful feedback effect where they were seeing people who were popping up on the scene talking about healthcare as it happened, putting them into their list, and the algorithm was then using that information to rank them higher in the super list, the master list.
So how is the art of list making? I admit I've sort of fallen out of the loop on this. How has it improved over time, or has it improved? How long have Twitter lists been out there?
I guess since October. I hope that's not wrong.
So it's about 6 months.
Yeah, then. That's right. Yeah. And I think about 11 or 12 million lists have been created. So I guess that's 2 million lists a month.
But what about the leading edge people, like Patrick LaForge? I mean,
yeah.
Is he still one of the leaders in this area?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. I think what's I mean, there's a number of things about lists, but I think the main thing is that the vast majority of Twitter lists, just like you would expect, people are primarily making for themselves.
I see.
And they're using it as kind of their own foldering system. And I think that there's a percentage of, you know, the population that likes keeping their desk.
Well, I'm not asking about the masses, Jonathan. I'm asking about the leaders.
I mean, right.
I mean, I guess my sort of subtext or what I'm wondering is, have they hit a wall? I mean,
I don't think they've hit a wall. I think that,
or you know,
yeah. I think that list following in Twitter is quite difficult to do still. And first of all, outside of things like T-Lists and Listorius and some other sort of search engines, which work in different ways, there actually isn't any good ways of finding lists except through your friends. So the first problem that you face is that it's very difficult to find them. The second problem is that once you have found them, there's this kind of concept of following them, which is this extra burden on the individual because it doesn't really make that much sense to them. And then after you've made the decision to follow them, they kind of appear on the right-hand side of your Twitter.com page, which may not be a place that you'd remember to look.
No,
so,
I never remember to look there. Following does not seem to be a very significant event from me, from my point of view as a user. When I follow a list, it doesn't change anything.
It doesn't actually do. It all it does is bookmark. Well, it indicates to the person creating the list that you have interest
in. Okay, let me try a different angle, because what I'm trying to get at here is, what would be different, or would it be different, if this were an open system versus the fact that it is all sort of gated by one company?
That's interesting. I mean,
by the way, let me just explain for people listening. Sure. The reason why I'm asking you of all people this question is because you are a regular at our Thursday evening meetups, and you raised this question very provocatively a couple of weeks ago, and we didn't really get a chance to follow up on it. So I wanted to dig in here a little bit and see what your thinking is on this. Okay.
Yeah. Well, so I'm not sure on, you know, my focus today is in providing pretty familiar navigational concepts for people who are trying to access the World Wide Web. And that's inspired by my mom and my wife, who really like the conversational and real-time nature of Twitter, love it, in fact, but have a hard time, in fact, an impossible time, assembling enough high quality and on topic feeds for it to be enough to keep coming back to on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. So they keep losing interest because, take my wife, who's really interested in fashion, she's never been able to assemble the 100 or 200 on topic high quality feeds that would make it a must check every time you get in the elevator kind of experience. So that's the problem that we're trying to solve.
Jonathan. I mean, Twitter to me is still, you know, 3+ years into it, still mostly potential as far as I'm concerned.
But I mean, I've invested heavily. I'm just guessing. You probably have enough critical mass of content in your. I don't know how heavily you're using Twitter, but let's just say
very heavily.
Okay, so unlike my wife, I'm guessing you probably put enough time into managing your Twitter feeds that you are getting a reasonably, high quality, high density information experience.
I disagree.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely disagree. Okay. I mean, I'm looking at my replies tab in Twitter right now, and I've posted some provocative things here in the last 24 hours, and most of the comments are honestly pretty mindless. Some of them are so bad that I've had to block the people.
Right.
You know, but most of them, I'm not getting, in terms of the conversational aspects of it, I'm not getting very much back, okay?
Right.
So if you then go look at the main timeline, when I hit the home thing, it's like very, very, very hit or miss.
Right.
However, I have a RSS feed reader, and that's a hotbed. I mean, basically, when I go there, I'm getting, every time I go back there, I'm getting 5 or 6 things that I think are really worth reading and are really interesting to me. It doesn't even matter what's going on. Last night for me was awesome. I mean, it was like all of a sudden the world's opening up. You can see the reporters changing gears. Although not enough, as far as I'm concerned, because, healthcare reform went from being a, sort of an insider's game, how these guys are playing with who the cares?
Right.
You know? I don't really care. What I care about now that I'm still not getting, that frustrates the hell out of me, is why haven't they focused now that it's like on the verge of being complete, which appears to be, right? Okay, what am I supposed to do now?
The how-to guide.
I'm a guy with a pre-existing condition, okay? Right. So am I paying too much for health insurance?
Right.
Well, it's all been theoretical. We've been on the roller coaster with these guys, Well, so in any case, it's still been fascinating. The last 24 hours have been great.
Yeah,
but still, in any given period of time, the news produced by the bloggers, and we've got a really eclectic, and the news organization, and, it's pretty good.
Yeah,
it's better by far than what I get on Twitter.
Well, I mean, I love comic books, right? I'm a big comic books guy, and
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah, and for me, if it hadn't been for kind of the comic book super list, I wouldn't know 90% of that those people. I wouldn't even know they were on Twitter. Actually, I'm surprised by the number.
But what does it mean for them to be on Twitter? What does that do for you?
Well, I like what they write about. I mean,
okay.
I'm interested in these guys. They're the artists or the editors. They're the thinkers in the comic book, and for me, it's fascinating to be able to dip into that stream and see what.
So were these guys bloggers before or not?
I don't think so.
No, I see. Okay.
I don't think so. Maybe they are. I don't know.
So maybe Twitter is training wheels for blogging.
Yeah. Or
I mean, not blogging, or maybe something like you know, Tumblr or Posterous.
I mean, they could definitely be. I imagine they would be ready now to write more. But a lot of these guys are creative anyway, so they'll tweet and they'll link to like a picture they just did or a comic they just wrote. So in a way, they are creatives. They just, you know, blogging was probably
interesting
too much of an extra thing. My point though is that if I had just typed the word comic books into the tweet search, I would never have found any of these people. I would have found people using the word comic books.
I see.
Right? You know what I mean? Like, there's no way to find the best 100 or 200 or whatever experts on comic books.
Let me be blunt now, okay? So you've got this great solution, right? Now you've got some way for people that want to, you know, have certain areas of interest. And you can sort of, if somebody shows up and says, I love comic books, you can give them an experience on Twitter that they'll find gratifying.
I think so.
Right?
Yeah.
But how do they find out about you?
Right. Yeah.
That's the problem,
that
right?
That is the problem.
Right.
That
is and so what's the answer?
Well, I mean, you know...
I don't want to put you on the spot.
I think it's fair.
I'm trying to lead you back into the whole open versus closed thing, too. I
mean, my business answer to that question is that we are partnering with leading social media / real-time apps. So, for example, TweetDeck is our biggest partner, and they're the biggest app.
Interesting.
And TweetDeck is putting our channels into the next version of the TweetDeck.
So what's the deal that you have with them to do that? Do they pay you? Do you pay them?
No, we just have a partnership. And
so there's no money changing hands at all?
No, because there's no business model yet, but if you...
Well, they could see it as a business model for them.
I think the point of having high-quality streams... is that they're presumably interesting places for transactions or marketers to want to live, and that if you can create high quality on topic and interesting streams, that the people who want to reach the audiences that care about that will pay to be included in that.
So are you going to merge with TweetDeck then?
No, I don't know.
It jumps to mind. It seems to me either you're going to merge with TweetDeck or they're going to do what you do.
Well, I mean, hopefully we'll find a way to continue working together because they're fantastic people. And
they are.
Somebody can be
fantastic and still be predatory. I mean, right? I mean, that's that's business, right?
I guess.
No.
You asked about distribution, and the answer is that we like the idea of there being this robust ecosystem of apps. We like it for a lot of reasons. First of all, because they are pioneering great new and completely unexpected user interfaces, but also because they represent a way for our channels to get carried. And so we think of the apps sort of like cable systems in the 80s, and we think of our channels sort of like, broadcasting.
Channels.
And we're going around to these apps who have very interesting, unique audiences of all different kinds. Tweety is completely different from TweetDeck, which is completely different from, Uber,
and
Twitter.
What way are they completely different?
They just have different audiences. They're built.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I can actually give you a lot of data.
What's the overview? Because I had explained to me that the conundrum for all of these products is that they tend to get pulled towards the sort of super users, that their feature sets all gravitate to the same place.
I think that does happen in some cases, because once you've built the basic stuff, you're the loudest. I don't want to speak for them, but the loudest.
Right.
Agitators in your user community are the people who are kind of the power users, right?
That's always the problem. Absolutely. Yeah.
But there are exceptions to this. I mean, TweetDeck to some extent has gotten simpler. And Tweety, I don't know if you use it, is a paradigm of simple design. So there's a lot of really interesting UIs. What I find so fascinating about it is that it's led to this kind of renaissance of creativity, because everyone to some extent wants to be a little different. And so you take a very simple problem, which is how to show a bunch of streams on a device, and people are like, well, I wonder if we could do it completely differently. So we've designed our platform to be entirely UI neutral, and it can fit into any of these paradigms. And so that's our answer, just to answer your question, to the distribution.
Right. Those partnerships with those guys.
Yeah.
That the client companies actually are in a really powerful position. I think that if Twitter ever gets competition, that's where it's going to come from.
What do you mean?
Well, any one of those, and I've talked with Ian Dodsworth about this. He's the guy who does TweetDeck.
He's the CEO of TweetDeck.
Right? Yeah. And yes, he's a hell of a nice guy. And he's also, I think, kind of an interesting sort of challenging thinker in this area.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so any one of them, if they wanted to, could create a route around Twitter by simply, and in fact, many of them have actually tried it, like Seismic has tried it, by including Facebook, right? Mm-hmm. And so when they include Facebook, they're saying basically, we give you something that Twitter doesn't give you, mm-hmm. something more than Twitter gives you. I think Brizzly is also doing Facebook.
I think they're focused on Google Buzz now, actually.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Some people doing Google Buzz.
Yeah.
I think the really interesting revolutionary thing that any one of them could do, and I understand that they generally don't want to do it because they're afraid of antagonizing Twitter Inc. For some reason, Facebook doesn't do it. But the really amazing thing they could do would be to support an open XML-based format that connects all their users together, and so that they could start adding features, really important features that aren't in Twitter.
Well, do you think all the apps would have to get together to do that?
No, or? I don't. I think that, in fact, well, first of all, if they do, it'll never happen, okay? Because it's the way these things work. You don't find, you know, a lot of competitors, a lot of, you know, sort of lip service paid to the idea of competitors working together, but that's mostly just PR. They really don't want to work with each other. They really want to get one up on each other. So no, I don't think that can be the way it'll happen. I think what'll happen is any one of them that has a very large installed base. So who are the leaders here? TweetDeck is the leader.
Tweety. EchoPhone, Uber Twitter.
Okay. Well, you know better than I do because I actually haven't heard of two of those. Mm-hmm. But okay. So
EchoPhone is the leading iPhone app. According
which
to
one?
EchoPhone.
EchoPhone.
According to my data, yeah.
Leading iPhone. Yep. Is it free?
I think there's a free version and a pay version.
Interesting. Because I've not gotten one for the iPhone. I'm now using the iPhone again, believe it or not. I stopped using it.
There's a lot of beautiful, there's some beautiful ones coming out for the iPad that are just...
Yeah, well, I bought an iPad, sort of like...
Gorgeous stuff.
Begrudgingly. Yeah, we need to talk about that a little bit. But let me just, like, get this idea out there, that if they connected themselves up, the first step would be to back up their users' tweet streams to this, you know, I would have, of course, asked them to use RSS. But you know what? If they use some other XML-based format, I don't really care. I mean, you know, I think that there's a certain amount of NIH at all of these companies. I think the good ones wouldn't try to create another format. I think the good ones would just use what's out there. But it honestly doesn't matter, okay?
And it's automatic, or you have to press a button, or?
It would be default on in a preference.
Okay.
And that they would eat a hosting charge, basically. In other words, the tweet stream would flow out.
So in the guise of a backup,
that's right.
You're basically creating a micro blog on a TweetDeck or what Twitter
domain. Yeah. Now the next step is, well, of course, you have another checkbox which says whether or not that stream is public. And I would say make that default on too, mm-hmm. because your tweet stream is public. You're not exposing any information that wasn't exposed before.
I see.
Right? Why? So I think you can leave that default turned on. And so now next time Twitter goes down,
I see.
You switch over and you start reading that. Okay.
I see.
Or there comes this moment, Jonathan, absolute decisive moment when you say, our users think 140 characters isn't enough.
Oh, this is your 140 character thing. Yeah.
Well, it could be that, or it could be we think that the URL should be metadata, not included in the, so therefore obviating the need for the URL shortener. You know,
right.
Where you then basically take that step where users of your product, which in these cases, some of them are millions of users, right?
Yeah.
All of a sudden get a feature that nobody else gets, right? And now the question is, okay, are you going to market that? Are you going to start telling other people's users that if you come over here, you're going to get this feature? Now, how long would that feature advantage last? It would last nanoseconds because the other guys would have to do it too.
Right.
Right? And that is what Twitter Inc. doesn't want to see happen.
Yeah.
Twitter Inc. doesn't want their position of dominance usurped.
Right.
And so when you talk with these guys, and I have talked
with the app people.
Yeah. When you talk with them privately, they're very frank about this. And they say, you know, we understand that there's an opportunity here. But frankly, we think we are the ones who are going to get the great special deal with Twitter. Mm-hmm. And we know we can't get that deal if we do this.
But Twitter hasn't been hasn't punished people who integrated Facebook.
Sure, they have.
MySpace.
Oh, not Facebook, but they have. That little space of, well, you know this better than I do, right? I mean, the little space on Twitter.com that's right below the number of people following and followers, that little advertising space is apparently hugely valuable space. Mm-hmm. And you just don't get it if they don't like you.
Yeah, I think that, I know that space is valuable. I'm just saying, I think there may be more inertia reasons than conspiracy reasons why this sort of thing hasn't happened. Because, you know, I mean, all of the big, at least desktop apps, have integrated very, very competitive. I mean, I presume Twitter and Facebook consider each other competitors, and yet they've all integrated the Twitter's biggest competitor. And I think...
Yeah, but there's a difference. And the psychology is different. And I've been around this loop with a fair number of different platform vendors, not just Twitter. And they accept Facebook. Okay, this is the psychology. Facebook, they accept. They may not, they may wish Facebook didn't exist, but they accept that it exists. What they don't want is to be, they see themselves as investing in these companies, Jonathan. They see themselves, Twitter sees themselves as almost like, you know,
like a partner.
Yeah, more than a partner, though. I mean, they are the air. They're the ecosystem. They're the, I called it a coral reef in the early days when I was writing about this stuff. If you start screwing around with that relationship, then I think, you know, if I were there, I would do it.
If you were who?
If I were an application vendor, I would discount the partnership thing because I think it's foolish. I think that, I saw this in the early 90s with Apple. I was a Mac developer, and, you know, these were not great days for Mac developers in the early 90s. And every app developer felt they could be the ones that got the deal with Apple and therefore acted accordingly. In other words, they were all scared of doing anything that upset Apple people. Right. And that wasn't about Apple strategic or Apple economics. That was about the employees, about what makes them unhappy. And those people have a whole psychology that's very weird. They think that they're never listened to, they're not paid well enough, they have to report to people, you know, five levels above them that don't care what they think. They just sweep into these meetings and make great pronouncements, you know. So the only people that have to listen to them are the developers because they can screw the developers. Right. And the guys at the top don't care if they screw the developers, so... Mm.
Well, you may be right, and you have a lot more experience with this.
Who knows? But
I would just say this. You know, I think every app developer, and we're kind of an app, so I think I can speak to that.
Yeah.
So yeah. I would say that on a kind of personal level, in terms of getting access to information, in terms of, you know, that Twitter really does, I mean, really does go way out of their way to help people build these applications.
Okay, I don't want to put you on the spot, but you described a conversation at this Thursday meetup. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, I would just say that one of the things that you wrestle with in thinking about a closed system, right, is the issue of features, right? Which is how, let me put this a completely different way. Let's say we were running Twitter.
Who?
You and me.
Oh.
Yeah, it's not going to happen, so let's... Believe me,
we're not the only people fantasizing about that.
I mean, for real. I mean, it's a really hard problem. Like, how do you draw a line in the sand and say...
No, it's not only a
hard problem. We're not going to build X so that the ecosystem can
build X.
It's
an impossible problem.
Well,
Jonathan,
it seems to me that, like, your first responsibility has to be to your own users. So you're always thinking about ways to make the experience
better. No, your
better.
First responsibility is to your shareholders, then perhaps to the users. But no, you're totally right. It's an incredibly difficult, in fact, it's an impossible problem.
So have you ever seen anyone master that?
No. Never. There's never been one that mastered it because it's impossible to master it. It's an impossible problem. The only place that it ever worked, okay, or the only place that it can ever work is when there is no platform vendor. When you have a platform with no platform vendor, that works. As soon as you have a company that is the owner of the platform, it eventually hits this wall super hard. And everybody's angry at everybody else, and things really stop working. I had so much experience with this, like PageMaker, for example. Mm-hmm. Aldous had a now probably people, a lot of people have never even heard of PageMaker now, but there was, they were, it was a desktop publishing program. They had a developer community, and they had a rule that said, we will not integrate another developer's feature for at least one version number. Okay? Yeah. They had to have a rule, or else they would have, nobody would have ever put a feature into a plugin in PageMaker.
Right.
Yeah, but it didn't work.
So wait, what's your, what would be your, I mean, obviously there's...
The only answer is, okay, is to, and I'm not saying it's much of an answer, okay, because it's not, is to do what we did at Userland with RSS. That was my conclusion. Okay, so we had a winner, right? And what we did was we just gave it away every way we could, and we disclaimed any control over it at all.
Right.
And it still wasn't enough for people.
But apply that thinking to the iPad for a second, right? Which I think could be extraordinarily
popular. The iPod is, the iPad is the ultimate extreme other end of the spectrum.
That's what I'm saying. Right. So now you've got something which stands to be, I think, one of the most compelling media platforms of all time, right? Just from a user experience.
Maybe, yeah.
I think it's... It's possible, right?
It's possible.
I'm certainly going to buy one.
I bought one.
And I can imagine really enjoying using them, especially like while watching sports or like watching the healthcare debate last. And I think the experience of combining an iPad with the rest of your life is going to be really compelling.
Okay.
Right?
So
my question is, you know, how would you apply the Wynarian theory of openness?
Wynarian?
Yeah, Wynarian.
That's a new word.
To an experience like that. All right. In other words, how would you create the conditions for creating as compelling a media product?
Well, sure. There is the whole other extreme, and I really sincerely hope that it comes about, that because that's the one I really want to buy. Okay, and I bought the iPad because I can't be on the sidelines and not using that the day the damn thing comes out, because I need to get the knowledge and the experience and all that. You know, that's why I'm buying it. I'm not buying it to support Apple because I think what Apple is doing is awful. I don't like it, okay? The other extreme is basically you make a piece of hardware, okay, and you make your money off of price, performance, and service. In other words, you have the best price, the thing performs like a bat out of hell, and when somebody has a problem, you deal with it in a very ethical, fair, and friendly way, okay? That's the way to earn a living in the technology business. Anything else, you're cutting corners, and you're gonna pay for it.
So just
Apple pays for it is they pay for it with complacency amongst their developers.
But let me ask you, Dave, do you think it's actually possible to create a great user experience in this completely vertically disaggregated?
Absolutely, no question that it's possible. No question.
So it's just unlikely.
I didn't say it's unlikely. I don't even think it's unlikely. It's just that you have to try to do it. You know, somebody has to actually set out to do it. And some people have, and eventually they're going to, like, for example, or I don't know if you're familiar with Bug Labs. That's another Fred Wilson investment. And I don't think they're going to too many different places, but they have that idea, basically, is open everything and, you know, let's see where that takes us,
right,
you know?
Right.
I think Android has some of the elements of that. That's one of the reasons why I have a Droid in my pocket and the iPhones at home, you know? You know, once I saw what Apple was doing with the App Store, I said, I just simply can't park myself here. I have to hope that something else works better, you know? The Apple II was a great example of this. You know why it works, Jonathan? Right. It worked because when the company is so small that effectively they can't have any control over the platform at all, then it effectively is a platform with no platform vendor and it works.
Yeah. Maybe like the early days of Netscape.
Right. Well, the web was the ultimate platform without a platform vendor. I mean, look, they had Netscape was like what we did with RSS. Netscape didn't have a choice because they came in after. You know, Tim Berners-Lee had already done the deed by making everything completely open, right? Mm-hmm. All they did were latching on to what he had done. But
60 seconds.
And they for sure tried to create some proprietary advantages. Absolutely did. But, you know, whatever. They could have done much better than they did. I would love to get a chance in my career, Jonathan, to try to do what you said. What you asked about is, could you really create a phenomenal user experience without locking the users in? And the answer is, for sure you can do it. It's like, come on, we went to the moon, right? I mean, that was done.
Right.
You could do this. I mean, There's no reason you couldn't do it.
Well, I mean, Twitter is a very interesting experiment in terms of at least how far you can get. I mean, I was just raving about the creativity of these app developers, and I stand by that. I think that the stuff that has been built is surprising and interesting.
We should have a debate about this sometime. Yeah.
10 seconds.
I would take. We're running over now, but we'll run like maybe 2-3 minutes. Okay, Adrian, if that's okay. Yeah. But you know, I actually think that you can see if they didn't tell me what the limits were on the Twitter API, I would be able to tell you in about 2 or 3 hours by looking at the app market, tell you exactly what they don't let people do, right? Because you can see that in the market, and you can see that in the sort of they don't go where you would like them to go. Hmm. You know, there's this whole rich sea of data being created out there. You know, why the hell can't we have the metadata grow without waiting for the platform vendor to decide that it can grow that way?
Right.
I mean, you know, have I ever seen a platform that had the ability to do that? You bet I have. The early Macintosh had the ability for, you know, developers could get together and say, why don't we throw this resource in the resource fork of every file, and you can read it, and I'll write it, or you can write it, and I'll read it, and we can deliver a new feature, and we can still compete. You know, and stuff like that would actually happen in the market. The internet, of course, itself has that ability. You know, TCP stacks are completely subject to perversion. We were able to do XML RPC on top of HTTP. Now, the purists of the web thought, oh, well, you can't do that, right? But we could do it. And there was nothing in HTTP that said you can't do stuff like that. But here we are stuck in Twitter land with this, some of the most stupid architectural decisions ever made in software, and we can't do anything about it. We have to wait for them to decide to let us do it, and that's a sign of a moribund market. And that's why I say the Twitter app space is not going anywhere.
Hmm.
It's not going anywhere.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, another way of seeing that it's not going anywhere is like, do you see anybody getting rich out there? I don't know if they are. I mean, I might be missing it. It's possible people can make money and you don't see it happening.
Right.
And so maybe they are making money, but I just don't know about it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, anyway. I would just say, you know, is that I would separate the perhaps inevitable structural outcomes of these kind of companies from the people within them. And maybe,
of course.
And maybe that's your point. Maybe your point is
that
the best intentioned people will still fall into this trap. I would just say that
it's no, there's the trap is so inevitable that it is even if they're perfect, you know, even if they're going to heaven because all their intentions are perfect. This is why you can't ever get into the business of being moral, making moral judgments about these things. That's why the whole issue about being evil and all the rest of that is crap. Because it is, you can never get there. You can't. The problem is structurally, you hit these walls no matter what happens. Mm. You just can't help it. People at Twitter could be saints. It still would happen. Sorry, I feel very strongly about this. Can you tell?
I think you feel strongly about it, yeah.
Yeah, I would love to do this again.
I'm just saying, to me, it's a little like healthcare reform, right? I mean, you know, I come from Canada, and I would have been comfortable with a single-payer system. It's what I'm used to.
Yeah.
But I still appreciate incrementalism, and, you know, I fight for incrementalism wherever I can. And so while I understand your sort of single-payer, all-or-nothing approach, I would just say that it also, there also on the margin are benefits to increasing openness.
I don't say that. Yeah. Actually, you're misreading me.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I use Twitter, and I use an iPhone, and I'm buying an iPad, so it's not to me all or nothing. I'm just throwing, you know, here I'm reading the tea leaves, and I'm trying to tell you what I think is going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know. I mean, can't tell you what's going to happen with. I, of course, think the single payer system is fine. It would be the way to go. No experience doing it. I do have experience with markets that are controlled by companies. And I also have the experience, I'm glad to say, I have one time in my life had the experience of working in a platform where there was no platform vendor. And I know which one I prefer by far, without any question at all.
Yeah.
I feel the freedom is so much more important. I would give features for freedom. You know, I mean, when I
saw...
That's a great line.
That's a blog title right there, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, when I saw http://blah, blah, 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 my first reaction was, oh, users will never do that. Well, guess what?
They did it.
They did it.
Yeah. You're right. They did it.
Jonathan, I love talking with you.
This is fun.
This is wonderful.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. And we have to do this again real soon.
Feel better, Jay.
Yeah, Jay. We love you.